The Guardian.
I'm Heather Stewart. This is Politics Weekly. A week of grief in Britain brings demands for answers and political action.
All acts of terrorism are cowardly attacks on innocent people. But this attack stands out for its appalling, sickening cowardice.
As the country comes to terms with its worst terrorist attack for more than a decade, a picture is emerging of the attacker, born and raised in Manchester and known to British intelligence. How has the government dealt with the aftermath of the attack? And as political campaigning tentatively resumes, what would the parties do about terrorism? Also this week, if 2016 saw victories for Brexit, then Trump, 2017 has seen populists soundly beaten in European elections. So is globalisation really in retreat? And what have the party's manifestos got to say about it? But first, the tragedy in Manchester suspended election campaigning this week as politicians united to condemn the deadly attack on a pop concert, many of whose victims were children. I'm joined by Alan Travis, The Guardian's Home Affairs editor. Alan, down in the Houses of Parliament where I work on Wednesday, we had the unusual sight of seeing the armed policemen we're used to seeing every day, accompanied by uniformed soldiers standing, you know, guarding us, as it were. How has this happened? This is part of the response to the terrorist attack, isn't it?
Totally response to the terrorist attack. And we had the unprecedented decision earlier this week to raise, not unprecedented, sorry, but a decision we hadn't seen for a decade, of raising the official threat level to critical from severe. Critical, which means that an attack is expected imminently. Although even in that, we saw this also unusually announced by the Prime Minister herself, and not by the Home Secretary, who has tended to make announcements about changes in the security threat level in recent years. That decision to raise the threat level to critical was accompanied by an announcement by May herself late at night on Tuesday that she was going to activate something called Operation Tempora, which authorises up to 3,800 troops to be made available to the police to backfill, was the word that the Home Secretary used, the role of armed police officers in guarding key points such as Buckingham Palace.
And there was some discussion on Wednesday about whether the reason this was necessary was because of cuts in police numbers. Is that fair at all?
No, I don't think particularly. I think there is a reduction in the number of armed firearms officers, but that has also mirrored the reduction, a 40% reduction in gun crime over the last 10 years. And if you're not going to arrest armed criminals, then you don't need so many armed police officers. And police officers have better things to do with their time, and they don't particularly want to be armed police officers. So I think we should, and the public quite rightly want to see an unarmed police force and maintain that in this country. So I don't think that that's the question. The main question which came out was whether this was purely for political motives or not, this decision to raise the threat level to critical and to deploy troops on the streets of Britain. And I think there is an argument which says that this has some technical operational basis to the decision, in that it's a decision to raise the threat level was made by the Joint Terrorism Analysis Assessment Centre, which is all the counterterrorism experts across government, the police and the security services. And there's one point there, which is unfortunately that because May was Home Secretary for 6 years, then obviously quite a number of characters on that assessment committee will have been people she worked with very closely over the last 6 years. For example, the National Security Advisor is Sir Mark Sedwell, who was the Permanent Secretary of the Home Office when she was Home Secretary. The head chair of the Joint Intelligence Committee is Charles Farr, who was head of the Office of Security and Counterterrorism at the Home Office for 6 years whilst she was Home Secretary. So there is some element of very close to May's view here, which leads to accusations of political overtones of such a decision.
And that is a legitimate concern, is it?
Well, I think maybe less so about the raising the issue threat level to critical. I think there is an intelligence security community who will have, if that wasn't valid, would have shouted quite loudly if that was purely being done for political purposes. I think the decision to deploy the troops, however, would have been a ministerial one, albeit on advice from the security chiefs and from the police, at the request of the police. But that was more of a political decision, I think.
We're bound to hear more, aren't we, in the remainder of the campaign about how to tackle, how to prevent attacks like these, how to tackle extremism and so on. There was a certain amount in the party manifestos about it, wasn't there? Do you expect to see new measures coming forward to deal with these kinds of attacks? Or do the police have the powers that they need already, really?
Theresa May has been frustrated on this issue over the last 2 years. 2 years ago, in a speech in May 2015, just before the 2015 general election, she actually set out a whole shopping list of how she wanted to take on and counter non-violent extremism in this country, as well as all the laws and the counterterrorism laws we have currently are framed about violent extremism, people who actually use violence, as opposed to non-violent extremism. And they've been stalled for 2 years, partly because of opposition of some of her cabinet colleagues, but also by a legal problem in Whitehall about getting a robust definition of extremism that wouldn't be immediately contested in the courts on free expression grounds. But this whole shopping list is there, and all the battery of new criminal offences, such as exclusion orders, banning non-violent extremism groups. But it goes beyond that in a way. And the manifesto reflects this, and she talked about this in her speech 2 years ago, that she wants to learn the lessons of the way racism was tackled
in the last century
in this country. And what she seems to be is a rather odd, alarming proposal there. She has for a commission to monitor and expose extremism in the public sector and in civil society. And I think what she's getting at there is from the Trojan horse affair in Birmingham schools. Her speech 2 years ago very specifically talked about trying to counter entryism within the public sector and within companies by extremists. And she has a unit inside the Home Office called the Extremism Analysis Unit, whose job it is to draw up lists of people and organizations which the government should engage with and those that they should not engage with. And those are particularly, we're talking about radical Islamist organizations or organizations who are non-violent, who would be either banned or would be regarded as extremism under Mrs. May's package. It's every indication that Mrs. May has not given up that shopping list at all. The surprising thing this week on that particular front was a statement by the Home Secretary Amber Rudd on the Today programme, I think on Wednesday morning, where she said that she had heard no demand from the police for the last 3 months for new tools or new powers to combat terrorism.
It's not what the manifesto says, is it? It specifically talks about new offences, doesn't it?
It talks about we'll consider new criminal offences and aggravated offences. So that seemed to be a great odds there. Maybe Mrs. Rudd takes a different view of these matters. It will be interesting to know. We'll see after the election. But there was one point where we saw a big flash where Mrs. May actually lost on this point 2 years ago, was amongst her shopping list was a proposal that Ofcom should be given the power to pre-censor broadcasters who gave a platform, as they saw it, to extremist speakers. There was a particularly notorious interview on Newsnight, and we had a leak from the cabinet that Sajid Javid, then the culture secretary, said this would amount to censorship in British television that we'd never had before. But Mrs. May had proposed that there should be some kind of pre-vetting of people who are allowed to appear on television. And one wonders if that was one of the more extreme proposals she had on her shopping list, whether she might revisit and refresh such proposals.
There's a very difficult line to walk there, isn't there, between trying to tackle some of these things and understandably wanting to catch them earlier, wanting to catch somebody before they get to the stage where they're willing to commit a violent act, and McCarthyism or kind of authoritarianism, or it's quite a difficult line to walk that, isn't it?
Absolutely. And the concern is that, you know, MI5 say there are 5,000 people who they regard as subjects of interest when it comes to terrorism and extremism in this country, and the question of how to keep track of all them. We've seen yet again the case in Manchester where the suicide bomber was said to be on the radar of MI5, albeit peripherally. And how you keep track of the movements of those people and with surveillance. Obviously, Mrs. May and the security services have completely new powers on their hands now as a result of the Snoopers Charters Act, the Investigatory Powers Act, which gives them much greater access to people's web histories and their online life, which no doubt they will be exploiting to the full. But also, beyond that, there'll be demands again for further powers.
What would Labour do differently, Alan, on some of these issues?
Well, there is a credibility problem because of the whole controversy about Jeremy Corbyn's past role in Northern Ireland and Northern Irish politics. But the Labour manifesto is curious on this particular point, because it says that they too agree that the security services and the police should be given all the resources they need to combat these problems. But then they accuse the Conservative government of failing to come up with any new measures in the last 2 years to combat extremism, which is true in the sense that Mrs. May's shopping list has been blocked for 2 years. But it's surprising to hear Labour make that particular criticism.
Because of that Investigatory Powers Act that you were just talking about.
Yeah, the only positive proposal they make is that the Prevent programme should be reviewed. And we know that already the review of counterterrorism laws, which has been stalled for 9 months now because of the problems we described earlier about opposition inside the cabinet, the only thing it has agreed is that the Prevent programme should be expanded. And I think the term as a result of the internal review was that it should be strengthened, not undermined, and they want to tackle that they now acknowledge to be the toxic reputation that Prevent programme has within Britain's music.
And the Prevent is about trying to catch young people, isn't it, and before they're radicalised, is it?
Yeah, it's about trying to tackle and disrupt the process of radicalisation.
The Guardian's Alan Travis there. Now, back in the 1990s, anti-globalisation was mainly a fringe pursuit, often allied to environmental or anarchist protest movements. Now it seems to be having a moment. With border walls back in fashion and trade disputes simmering, even politicians previously been reliably pro-market are starting to sound protectionist. So what's going on? And is it relevant to the election Britain will hold in 2 weeks' time? Joining me now are the economist Stephen King and our economics editor Larry Elliott. Now, Stephen, you've written a book recently about the future of globalisation. We're having conversations now, aren't we, that we haven't had for a long time about whether this process is inevitable.
Yes, that's right. The book is called Grave New World, nice cheerful title. I started writing it back in 2015, and that year is important to the extent that it predates Brexit and it predates Trump. So I was trying to sort of get to a sort of point whereby I was arguing that there were some historical forces at work that might have led to things like Brexit and Trump, although I wasn't at the time anticipating that they actually would happen within the space of a year or two. And I suppose it goes back to this, that if you go back to 1989, the fall of the Berlin Wall, you also had the publication of the paper by Francis Fukuyama, The End of History. And in it, he made this very bold claim that effectively autocracies were in retreat, that Western liberal democracy and free market capitalism would triumph, and that in one sense, globalization would naturally spread, raise incomes around the world, and everyone could be better off and everyone would be happier. Now, to a certain degree, the argument worked, to the extent that countries like China have been through an extraordinary transformation over the last 20 or 30 years. But of course, China is a peculiarity because it's had economic success, but it's not a liberal democracy. And at the same time, the West has had real adjustment costs and real adjustment problems coping with the new dynamism coming through in other parts of the world. So two things to note here. The first is that Western economic growth has been much lower than people had expected, which has created all sorts of questions about public services and so on over the last few years. And the other big problem, of course, is the fact that you've got rising levels of income inequality. In the US, it's actually the kind of proper normal measure of income inequality, to the extent that the very rich have become extremely rich and the bottom 60% have done rather poorly, which is what Trump would refer to as the kind of forgotten men and women of America. But in the UK, it's less a kind of standard income inequality issue, but it's more a regional story. So Greater London's done well, but Wales has done very poorly. And within the Eurozone, it's a story between, say, Germany and Italy, whereby Germany has sort of moved ahead and become much, much wealthier, and Italy's been totally stagnant. Now, to be fair, there's lots of potential explanations for why this has happened. It doesn't have to be globalization. It might be the effect of technology. It might be failures in education and so on. But from a political point of view, it's become really quite easy to say, we'll blame somebody else for our difficulties. We'll blame the other, whether the other is China, Mexico, or the stranger in your midst, or whatever it might be. But there's a sense that whereas globalization was a story of uniting people, we're now coming to a political narrative which is dividing people, basically blaming other people for the difficulties that each individual country might have.
I mean, you were talking about those forces and that you wouldn't necessarily have predicted Brexit, or you wouldn't necessarily have predicted Trump. But is that how you see those kinds of decisions? It's people saying the system's not working terribly well for me. This globalization's not working terribly well for me. That's certainly how Theresa May talks about it, for example. She certainly says the Brexit vote tells us there were people who were left behind who aren't doing terribly well, and we need to do things differently.
Well, I think there's certainly a case for doing things differently, to the extent that if you've got a country whereby some regions are doing extremely well and others are doing extremely badly, or at least they're not progressing in the usual kind of way, there have to be questions as to what has gone wrong. The difficulty for me is if you blame globalization alone and say this is the problem, then you can quickly move towards a kind of protectionist, isolationist model where each country pulls away from its international obligations and responsibilities. And before you know it, you're back to some of the kind of protectionist histories of the past. So, you know, maybe the interwar period, which was a pretty awful period economically, periods during the 19th century where, again, things became very difficult because of a greater level of protectionism, or even the sense of superpower rivalries beginning to return. I mean, we think about the story in the UK alone, but when you think about the global changes that are taking place, you can easily imagine a story in the years ahead where you've got rivalry between the States, between China, Russia, almost a kind of real-life version of 1984, where you think about Oceania, Eurasia, East Asia battling against each other, and here you've got a real-life version of that beginning to come through.
And Larry, you've been analysing the party's manifestos before campaigning halted this week. They're extraordinarily different, aren't they, from what we saw? Our last general election was only 2 years ago, and at that point, it was hard to find much difference between the two, wasn't it? We were all talking about the deficit and how quickly we were going to eliminate it. We're now seeing very different tone, aren't we, from both major parties?
Yes, I think that in economics, the country and the parties have moved to the left. I mean, I think that the Tory manifesto is the most left-wing that I can recall in all my time in journalism. I mean, it's right back to Ted Heath-style interventionism. I mean, there's even a section about supporting the shipbuilding industry, which is, you know, something you wouldn't have heard any time since the early 1970s from the Tory manifesto.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's and just the sort of philosophy behind it, you know, saying we are not a party that supports unbridled free markets. And, you know, it's a very, very much a change of heart from previous Tory manifestos, even the 2015 manifesto, which was much more globalist, much more free market, and in a sense much more austerity based than the current one. And the Labour manifesto is clearly more to the left of Miliband or Brown, you know, with very big spending commitments. Most of the current spending backed up by tax increases. Whether the Labour would actually raise the taxes to pay for the spending is another matter. But I mean, it is a very, very big shift to the left. And both parties, I think, have moved to the left in economics. The country, I think, since the financial crisis, has moved leftwards in economics, moved rightwards in other areas of politics.
And do you think, so if you speak to Jeremy Corbyn and his team, they would say, we've pushed some of these issues onto the agenda. We've pushed anti-austerity. We've pushed, you know, getting rid of some of these spending cuts and to some extent, you know, state intervention, things like that, onto the agenda. But part of the debate is going on within the Tory party, isn't it? I mean, how has the pendulum swung so far in such a short time, do you think?
I think that's two things have happened and they've coincided. One was the Brexit vote, I think, which led to the defeat of that faction in the Tory party, the Cameron Osborne globalist wing, and brought into office Theresa May, who has a completely different view and a different analysis. So she interpreted the Brexit vote as a repudiation by a large number of people of the sort of economic policies that the Tory party had been pursuing for the previous 6 years. And, you know, those policies had not been wonderfully successful, as Stephen said. You know, growth had been very weak by historic standards. Incomes per head had been particularly weak. I mean, there had been two good years in 2015 and 2016 where inflation fell remarkably fast because of oil prices and then now bounced back. Real incomes are now falling again. So you can see why the Conservative Party feels the need to address some of those issues, because historically, a government that was going into an election with real incomes falling, as this one is, would be on the way to an election defeat. I mean, normally governments don't call elections when the economy is in its current state. I mean, you know, economy only grew 0.2% in the first quarter. Prices are rising faster than wages. That's not normally a great recipe for electoral success.
Mm. And Stephen, you talked about the sort of, there's a kind of cultural layer of it too, isn't there, or a political layer of it. So Theresa May talks about you know, she, in her conference speech last autumn, she talked about, you know, she spoke against people who are sort of citizens of nowhere. You know, she doesn't yes. like that idea that you could be in Davos or you could be in the south of France or you could be in Singapore or Bangalore. She you know, we've sort of brought nation back in, haven't we? Do you worry about that a bit, or was that too much missing from the sort of Cameron Osborne jet set version of the world?
Well, I do worry about it a bit, because the problem is, when you get to the idea of saying that you're a citizen of somewhere, then you're defining other people as citizens who are not part of somewhere. It's a kind of club mentality almost, that people in one particular country have to be defined by their national status. But once you get into that debate, you have to define who other people are in relation to that particular country. And people who are on the fringe, who are in an ambiguous position, end up in a rather awkward place. I also think that when we think about the sort of the reversal of globalization, the odd thing about the Tory party currently, there are some of them who reach out to a kind of a global Britain, who want to do more trade with
Asia. And for whom
Asia.
That was what Brexit was about, right? It was about becoming more free, more buccaneering, more free trading.
Yes, and so that part of the globalization debate, you might say, is still there in some parts of the Tory party. On the other hand, one other big feature of globalization is precisely the movement of people across borders. So on the one hand, you've got people in the Tory party reaching out towards doing trade with the rest of the world. On the other hand, you've got people saying they must sort of stop immigration to a significant degree. And those two, I didn't think, are entirely consistent with each other in terms of the message of how we connect with what's happening elsewhere in the world.
Both parties are conflicted on globalisation, aren't they, really? Because Labour would accept...
In different ways, yeah.
Labour would accept a financial transaction tax. It would accept wholeheartedly the idea that capital movements should be restricted, but it would have much more difficulty with Labour movements being restricted.
People, yeah.
The Conservative Party is completely up for the idea that the borders should be closed to people, but is in favour of free movement of capital. So both parties are, to an extent...
In one sense, they're cherry-picking certain parts of the EU single market, because the single market is about the four freedoms.
Vote, reading that vote last year in particular ways. I mean, some of this has to come to a head, doesn't it, when we go through the process of Brexit? We haven't had the negotiations yet. We don't know what kind of deal or what kind of relationship we're going to have. We have to resolve some of these kind of contradictions, don't we? Do you worry about where we're going to end up when it actually happens?
Yes. I mean, we can already see some of the consequences of it. I mean, Larry was just talking about the fact that real wages are being squeezed, that inflation is rising faster than wages themselves. And one reason for that, of course, is the fall in sterling that occurred after Brexit, which was a response to the idea that lots of companies perhaps that would have chosen to invest in Britain as part of the EU will now choose to go somewhere else because Britain no longer has the full access to the single market. So there are already consequences coming through. But I think that if Britain is focused on the idea of controlling immigration, which appears to be the strong Tory message in this election, then it's a question then of what Europe does in not so much in retaliation, but what it does to say, okay, if we're actually controlling immigration in the UK, we haven't got the free movement that we had previously, then in return, you're going to have some cost associated with access to other aspects of the single market. So whether it's in goods, services, or whatever it might be, life will become more difficult. And of course, it's what I was saying, going to WTO rules, but WTO rules are nothing compared with what we have in terms of access to the EU currently. So there may be some consequences.
WTO rules, this is the idea of plunging out of the EU without a trade deal and just trading on
absolutely right.
WTO relationship. You trade
in the same way with the EU as China would, or the Americans would, or any other country that doesn't have a trade deal with.
And of course, many of those countries choose to invest in the EU because they can't get across the sort of common external tariff areas, so they make stuff in the EU rather than shipping it from elsewhere
for
to the
EU market.
Yes, so then you end up with difficulty. If you're not part of that story, then the investment that would have come into your country, like Japanese investment, for example, for cars, will go somewhere else, and that again has a cost for the UK.
Mm. But now, Larry, you're not a fan of neoliberalism or whatever we call that package of kind of Cameron Osborne free market ideas, and you are a fan of Brexit. Do you feel quite optimistic about the idea that we're now having conversations about some of these things that we haven't had for a while? Do you think we might get the sort of structural reforms that the economy needs?
I think that the good thing about Brexit is that it's forced politicians to address some of these big issues. And I think the sort of counterfactual is, what would have happened had Cameron and Osborne won the vote last year, then life would have carried on pretty much as before. There'd have been no talk about an industrial strategy. There'd have been no talk about, you know, distributing growth more fairly outside of London to the regions. And some of that, austerity would have carried on in exactly the same brutal form as it was. I mean, some of the things that have happened since the Brexit vote, I think, have been quite positive. I mean, I think it's good that the Theresa May is talking about, you know, interventionist industrial strategy, you know, supporting growth industries. I think some of that stuff is really quite encouraging, and I think that it has created space for politicians to talk about some of these deep structural issues. I mean, you know, it remains to be seen whether we will actually take advantage of that opportunity to deal with things like, you know, underinvestment, productivity challenge. I mean, Stephen's right, the productivity challenge in the UK is not a general economy-wide issue. It takes someone in the North East 5 days to produce what someone in London can produce in 3.5 days. It's very much a regional. It's very much a regional issue, and so I think there are massive, massive challenges ahead from the Brexit process. But it does actually create the space to actually talk and come up with ideas that will deal with these policies, and they would have needed to be dealt with in or outside of the EU.
So, Larry, can I just ask you a question on that? Because you mentioned earlier on this idea of this being rather similar to a sort of Ted Heath type manifesto, but I mean, I was quite young at that in those days, as were you. But
careful now.
But I seem to recall that the 70s weren't exactly the most vibrant experience for the UK. So, although I can understand why you're saying it's great to focus on these things and to get a sense of dealing with issues that we haven't been able to deal with within the EU, how confident are you that a sort of Ted Heath type manifesto really would work?
Well, I was not a big fan of Ted Heath. I mean, I was more you know, Tony Benn-Siege economy man in the 1970s, of which Corbyn, of course, is was a big fan too. So, I mean, I think that it's a bigger challenge for the left in some ways than it is for the parties of the right, because if you think historically, back to the 30s when there was, you know, politics moved to the right more quickly than it did to the left. I mean, it took quite a long time for the left to get its act together, and it took till after the Second World War really before social democracy became embedded in Western countries. So I think it's more of a challenge for parties of the left than it is for parties of the right, to be frank. I think that, you know, I'm not really convinced that Theresa May's, you know, interventionist strategy will work, because she seems to sort of buckle quite quickly to when any pressure is put on. I mean, one example, putting workers on boards, that was quite quickly stamped on by the CBI. Their experience of the election campaign is that this lady is for turning quite easily. I mean, I think it's quite interesting when you talk to people around Corbyn and McDonnell. I mean, one of the reasons I think that they've accepted Brexit quite quickly is that they do see Brexit as a way of vindicating some of the left critique of globalisation of the past.
And there are things they would like to revisit state aid rules, for example.
State aid rules, varying VAT levels, you know, it gives you freedom to change the tax system. So they would take advantage of it. And I think, to an extent, let's try it.
Stephen, these are debates, aren't they, that are being played out? I mean, this is our particular version of this globalisation debate, but they're being played out, aren't they, across Europe, in the States, across the world, really?
Well, obviously, in Europe, you had the French presidential election result. Everyone, you know, sees upon that and says it's great that Macron has won, but worth remembering that Le Pen got about, 35% or something of the vote, which is an enormous number of people voting for someone who's really quite on the far right. In the US, you know, a year and a half, 2 years ago, you know, if I mentioned to people, do you think there's a chance that Trump could possibly win? They just laugh at you and say, come on, don't be ridiculous. And yet here we are.
Even a few weeks before, to be honest.
So that's been a really big shock. I think when you look at other parts of Europe, not so much the sort of Germany-France relationship, but look at countries like Poland, Hungary, they've got far-right or right-wing people in power who offer a very odd sort of mix of views given their membership of the European Union. You've got difficulties in Greece, Italy, Spain, which politically, perhaps in their case, are not seeing moves to the right, but at the same time have moved towards more populist or more sceptical parties or people who...
Not trusting the usual guys to run things.
Absolutely right. So in each case, there's a kind of clawing back from the kind of international arrangements that we've seen in the past. My concern really is that for all the benefits in terms of sovereignty gained in the short run, it is nevertheless the case that these international institutions have kind of set the rules of the game that have stopped individual countries from doing completely dumb things.
Well, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to Stephen King, Larry Elliott, and Alan Travis. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Heather Stewart. Thanks for listening.